The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. Last week, the French President Nicolas Sarkozy and the American President Barack Obama met in France at an important summit meeting of world leaders. During that meeting, there was an exchange between the French and American presidents in a private conversation that was accidentally overheard and broadcast to journalists that has attracted a lot of attention around the world. During the conversation between these two men, Nicolas Sarkozy called the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a liar. He said, "I cannot bear Netanyahu. He's a liar." In response to that, Obama, who was not aware that the microphones in their meeting room had been switched on and thereby enabling reporters in a separate location to listen, said, "You're sick of him, but I have to deal with him every day," unquote. Well, that remark has gotten a lot of attention. The White House has refused to comment on it, of course, because it's an embarrassment. But the conversation is important and should be commented on because of what it says about an important reality of not only world politics, but also of American politics today. The importance isn't that Netanyahu's a liar. That's bad enough. And it's especially remarkable because the long track record of lies by the Israeli Prime Minister is nothing new. It's more remarkable because the American political establishment of both parties, both Democrat and Republican, publicly praise and honor Netanyahu as a great leader. A few months ago, when Netanyahu visited the United States, he addressed a joint session of the U.S. Congress and was, by one count, given 30 standing ovations, more than the U.S. Congress gives to any American leader, and more than Netanyahu gets even from his own parliament in Israel. Now, that's not because Netanyahu himself is honored by these politicians, and the frustration that the French president and Obama feel about this man isn't the frustration over one individual or even the of Netanyahu because he's the leader of Israel. It's really frustration and really honor in the case of the Congress being given not to Netanyahu or to Israel, but to the tremendous power behind this man and the power that he's able to mobilize. That is the power of the organized Jewish community here in the United States. Now, a lot of people use different terms to describe this power. Some people talk about the Israel lobby. Others talk about the Jewish lobby. I use the term Jewish Zionist power, and others use different terms. But whatever the name that one wants to give it, this is a reality, an important, central reality in our time, that the recent recorded conversation between the American and French presidents once again underscores, and which is essential to understand for an understanding of politics in our world today. Now, relations between Obama and Netanyahu have been very slippery and contentious almost from the very beginning, because Barack Obama has been trying to uphold U.S. policy with regard to the Israel-Palestine issue consistent with what international law is and what the policy has been of American presidents for the past 40 years. From 1967 until the present, both international law and American policy has been that Israel should not build settlements in the occupied Palestinian West Bank territories, and that the final contour or outline of a peace settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians should be on the basis of the 1967 borders. There's nothing new about that. This has been, as I said, U.S. policy since 1967. And Barack Obama has tried to uphold that policy consistent with this longstanding American view of the situation, and also consistent with what the world consensus is about that. But because Obama has said that, he's been fiercely criticized by Republicans for supposedly selling out Israel. He's been attacked in particular by Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney, by Rick Perry, and by Michelle Bachmann, as well as others. But those three have strongly criticized Obama for supposedly selling out Israel. Well, the fact of the matter is that Obama has done nothing but, has not at all sold out Israel. In fact, the remarkable thing that is in his actual policies, Barack Obama has been even more pro-Israeli, if that's possible, than the man who's considered the great hero of many Republicans, Ronald Reagan. When Ronald Reagan was president, he was even more emphatic and explicit that Israel should not build any more settlements, that these settlements were not going to be permitted by the United States, and was even more explicit than Barack Obama has been that the settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict would be on the basis of the 1967 borders and consistent with 1967 UN Security Council Resolution 242. Now, this Security Council Resolution, which was adopted by the UN Security Council, has the force of the status of international law. If America ignores or goes against Security Council Resolution 242, it's in effect saying that international law has no means nothing to the American government. Now, of course, the United States has violated international law in many other ways, but much of the world, and especially millions of people and governments in Muslim and Arab countries and many other countries, insist that the Israel-Palestine issue is so important that it's crucially, vitally important that the United States maintain its adherence, that it continue to honor Resolution 242. Now, when Barack Obama, some months ago, through himself and also through Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, said that Israel should not build more settlements, he and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton refrained from referring to these settlements as illegal. They called them an obstacle. They called them a unhelpful. They said that they would be not helpful for a peace process. But the United States government refused to call them illegal. Now, the reason for this is that if the U.S. calls them illegal, then the next step, obviously, is that other countries will insist that the United States do something to back up its words. But the U.S. government has not done that. This contrast, this conflict, and this chasm between America's words and its actions has been an increasing embarrassment for the United States around the world. Now, not so much in the United States, because the media here is so much in the grip of this Jewish Zionist power, and because American politicians are as corrupt and as subservient to this power as they are, Americans are more misled and more misguided on this issue, worse informed than people in perhaps any other country in the world. But one of the interesting aspects of the remark by Obama to Sarkozy in this recorded conversation that they didn't know was being listened to by others are this. First of all, Obama talked about how he has to deal with Netanyahu every day. That was his remark. I have to deal with him every day. Well, that's already an extraordinary thing. The United States president doesn't deal every day with the Prime Minister of Britain or the Prime Minister of Canada or the Chancellor of Germany or any other country. But he deals, as Obama says, every day with Israel. That means that Israel has a role and a relationship to the United States far, far out of proportion to its real standing in the world. After all, Israel is basically a very small country, smaller than almost all other countries around the world, with a population of no more than 6, 7, 8 million people, a very small population. But the real power of Israel is not in its capabilities in Israel proper. It's because of the ties, of course, it has with the organized Jewish community here in the United States. And Obama's frustration with Israel is the frustration that virtually every American president since the founding of Israel has had over the years. When Jimmy Carter, after he became president, it was revealed that he had been completely frustrated dealing with Israel and Netanyahu as well as Obama, and used even obscene language to describe the arrogance, the unbelievable arrogance that Israel has in dealing with the United States. This was reported in the memoirs, for example, of Dennis Ross, an important Clinton administration official. Jimmy Carter has also described his frustration in dealing with Israel, that Israel will say one thing in public and give pledges to the United States in private, and then completely violate and ignore those pledges and do something very different. In other words, Israelis lie. They deceive the United States and they deceive the world and lie to the world. And Jimmy Carter also recorded in his memoirs this frustration in dealing with the Israeli leaders. But it goes back even further than that. It goes back to the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, what I call the original sin of U.S. relations with Israel and the original sin of U.S. policy in the Middle East. In 1948, President Truman was faced with the question of whether the U.S. government should even recognize the new Zionist state being established in Palestine. At that time, it wasn't a question of whether the U.S. would be giving military aid to Israel or whether it would be supporting Israel in a war against Iran or any other country. It was a question of whether the United States should even recognize the State of Israel. And there was an important White House meeting shortly before the Zionists declared the independence or proclaimed the State of Israel over this question. At this important White House meeting, President Truman was briefed by Clark Clifford, who was an important advisor to Truman on domestic U.S. Political affairs. He was no specialist by any stretch of the imagination about the Middle East. He didn't even have experience in international affairs. But at this meeting, Clark Clifford laid out reasons why he said Truman should recognize and the United States should recognize the State of Israel. Well, the reasons he gave were essentially twofold. First, he said the United States should be sympathetic to Jews because of what they had suffered in World War II. And second, he said that he gave biblical reasons why Israel was, or the Palestine, or the Holy Land, was important for Jewish religious sensibilities. Well, however emotionally appealing these arguments might be to some people, they are trivial and irrelevant arguments when dealing with the real interests of the United States and the principles of the United States, or of any country, and what's good for the world. As Clark Clifford was laying out these reasons, the Secretary of State of the United States, George Marshall, listened with mounting frustration and anger over what was being said. Now, George Marshall wasn't just any U.S. Secretary of State. He had been the chief of staff, that is, the highest-ranking military official of the United States, during World War II. He was famous and well-remembered for a lot of other reasons. But he was a man of very great stature, much greater stature as Secretary of State in 1948 than Hillary Clinton is today. Well, when Clark Clifford was done giving reasons why the U.S. should recognize Israel, George Marshall was so furious that he said that if President Truman were to go ahead and recognize the State of Israel, he would be demeaning the office of the United States, and that to such a degree that he, Marshall, would not see fit to support the president in the next election. That's an astonishing statement coming from a man of that position and that stature. He said that to recognize the State of Israel would be to put domestic political considerations above the interests of the United States. In effect, he was accusing President Truman of corruption, of not doing what's best for the United States in order to help his own political career and the careers of others in the Democratic Party. Well, it's very important to remember that already in 1948, the basic conflict between what's good for America and what's right for the world and the principles that the United States claims to uphold, on the one hand, were in place against power political reality in domestic American politics on the other. That is, that already in 1948, the American president and American politicians could decide to do what was advantageous to them and their cronies and colleagues in their party, or they could do what was best for Americans and for the world and consistent with the principles they claim to uphold. But already in 1948, President Truman set aside the interests of America and the world and principle and decided to recognize the State of Israel against the advice of his own Secretary of State. And not only that, he rejected the advice of every high-ranking American official who had anything to do with American, with international affairs, and with especially with Middle East policy. The head of the U.S. State Department's Planning Bureau and Policy Bureau, George Kennan, urged President Truman not to recognize the State of Israel. And the head of the Middle East branch, affairs branch of the State Department, Loy Henderson, prophetically warned that if the United States were to recognize Israel and side with the Zionists, we would inevitably be drawn into conflicts that are not our affair, that would be harmful to the United States, and that the long-term interests of our country would be greatly harmed by supporting the Zionists. Now, all this was laid out already in 1948, and it's now even more true, and more obviously true today, than it was even then. Just a few weeks ago, the new American ambassador to Israel, a man named Daniel Shapiro, gave a talk to a Jewish group here in the United States. Perhaps he did not think or realize that these remarks given to this audience would be picked up and publicized by others, including the Institute for Historical Review, and including me here. In this talk, the ambassador, Daniel Shapiro, said this: "The test of every policy the administration develops in the Middle East is whether it is consistent with the goal of ensuring Israel's future as a secure Jewish democratic state. That is a commitment that runs as a common thread through our entire government." Unquote. Well, this is extremely important. This new U.S. ambassador to Israel was acknowledging an important point that we've been making for many years. That is that U.S. policy in the Middle East is driven by concern for Israel's security and identity as a Jewish ethno-religious state, and not by what is good, what is best for America and the world. Again, the test of every policy, he said, not any, some policies, every policy in the Middle East, is whether it is consistent with the goal of ensuring Israel's future as a Jewish democratic state. Now, what that means in reality is that the U.S., by upholding Israel's special character as a Jewish state, is affirming Israel's right and policy of discriminating against non-Jews, which it does as a matter of policy. Now, this is a relationship that the United States has with Israel, not only unique in supporting its security interests, but unique also in supporting even its identity as a country. That's something the United States doesn't do with any other country in the world. It's what the politicians call a special relationship. It's special, all right, because it's a reflection more blatantly and more obviously than in any other case of bending not to and doing not what is good for Americans and the world, but as a reflection of the power of this organized Jewish community in America, which makes up only 2-3% of the population of the United States. One person who has commented on this recently is James Petras. James Petras is a very shrewd observer of international affairs. He has a special expertise in Latin America. He's a professor in upstate New York. And he has written very worthwhile books and commentaries and articles about international affairs, and particularly about U.S. policy in the Middle East. He commented recently on Obama's speech at the United Nations General Assembly a few weeks ago, and talked about this, as other observers have, as being a capitulation, a complete and total capitulation to Jewish Zionist power, and makes the point that what Obama is doing is ensuring his support from wealthy Jewish and pro-Israel donors and wealthy people to support his re-election campaign and the political campaigns of others in the Democratic Party. James Petras refers in this essay and in other essays to what he calls the Zionist power configuration. He calls it the ZPG. Now, again, this is another way, another term to be used, because this hydra, this monster of power, is called by different names. As I mentioned earlier, the Israel lobby, the organized Jewish community, Jewish Zionist power, and James Petras calls it the Zionist power configuration. And he makes the point that from the angle of satisfying the U.S. Zionist power configuration and securing a massive flow of re-election financing, Obama's U.N. speech was a smashing success. He also says that Obama's re-election campaign from April to the end of September of this year has received already tens of millions of dollars from wealthy pro-Israel Jewish fundraisers and contributors, as well as endorsements from right-wing U.S. Jewish and Israeli politicians. All this is an expression, once again, of this tremendous power of which the discussion by Sarkozy and Obama is only a tiny indication of a much deeper and more profound reality with very major consequences for the United States and the world. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume shortly with the second half of this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
In a major public speech, Iran's president insisted his country won't retreat one iota from its nuclear program. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad slammed the International Nuclear Watchdog's newly released report, suggesting Tehran might be close to developing atomic weapons. Its findings came days after Israel bluntly considered military action against Iran, raising fears the report could be a pretext to an attack. Ganna Chichikan has more on the atomic study.
The UN nuclear watchdog found no smoking gun, but hyped up fears that Iran continues research on nuclear weapons.
It doesn't say Iran is building a weapon, but it says it's collecting all the information it would need to do so and has a lot of technology.
The International Atomic Energy Agency claims to have Iranian computer models of nuclear warheads, which the watchdog views as a possible indication that Iran plans to build an atomic bomb. Among other evidence, a satellite image of a steel container that might be used to secretly test the high explosives needed to trigger a nuclear weapon.
I would be very skeptical about this report that's coming out from the International Atomic Energy Agency, because the IAEA doesn't really have any intelligence capabilities of its own. And if it's relying on reports that are coming from other people, I would rather suspect those reports are coming from the United States and Israel.
The precedent of U.S. intelligence presenting false evidence to build a case for the war in Iraq raises alarm bells as to the accuracy of the Atomic Agency's latest report on Iran.
You may have a piece of evidence of some kind, but that piece of evidence is subject to your interpretation as to what it means. When they saw aerial photographs in Iraq showing certain things, they interpreted those photographs to mean something which was not correct.
Back in 2003, the U.S. was adamant. Its evidence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and terrorist activity was as solid as could be. Satellite images of a base where Saddam Hussein was believed to train al-Qaeda terrorists, evidence of mobile labs for biological weapons, aluminum tubes presented as components of centrifuges to enrich uranium. All of the above proved to be a hoax. And yet, it was enough to start a war that would last 8+ years and kill more than 100,000 civilians.
Israel is considering military action to take out Iran's nuclear facilities preemptively.
The question many now ask is, could the UN's atomic watchdog report serve as a justification to start a war with Iran? Security experts say the consequences for such action would be catastrophic.
We would most likely see new kinds of attacks, probably on Israel from Hezbollah or other groups. We'd see attacks on American troops, perhaps in Iraq and Afghanistan, even more than what we've seen so far. Iran, I mean, could return.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about the historical background to the tension between Israel and the Obama administration over U.S. policy in the Middle East, and how Obama had expressed frustration with dealing with Benjamin Netanyahu, and in a remark made to President Sarkozy. in which he said, well, you're frustrated, I am too, because I have to deal with Netanyahu every day. But the important thing is not just Benjamin Netanyahu, not just the difficulty with Israel, with by American presidents who are trying to do what is consistent with U.S. and world interests on the one hand, and with trying to placate the implacable Jewish Zionist power on the other hand, but that this is part of a long-standing problem that every American president in recent years has had to face. As I mentioned earlier, this goes back even to President Truman. His frustration was expressed, he expressed once when he said, Jesus Christ himself couldn't keep him happy. How the heck does anybody expect me to do so? That is referring to the organized Jewish community in the United States, even in 1948. A high point of this came probably in 1972, during a private White House meeting between President Richard Nixon and the Reverend Billy Graham, who was probably the nation's best-known Christian evangelist at the time. They were discussing the power of Jews in the United States, and Billy Graham said to Nixon, this stranglehold, that's his word, this stranglehold has got to be broken or the country's going down the drain. In response to that, Nixon said, you believe that? And Graham said, yes, sir. And Nixon said, oh boy, so do I. I can't ever say that, but I believe it. Now, the incredible thing here is that even though Richard Nixon was the most, supposedly, the most powerful political leader in the world at that time, he was less powerful than the organized Jewish community. In fact, the organized Jewish community was so powerful that it was able to silence Nixon, and by extension, every American president, from talking about even the reality of this power, this Jewish Zionist power in our society. In other words, as powerful as he was, Richard Nixon, President of the United States, feared a power even greater than his own, a power of the organized Jewish community, Jewish Zionist power in the United States. Now, I mentioned earlier, and I have made this point over and over, about how dangerous this is for the United States, because increasingly the United States and Israel are isolated in the world because the consequences of Israel's policies and the consequences of Israeli Jewish Zionist power is becoming more and more obvious and has more and more profound consequences for the world. And for more than 20 years, I and the Institute for Historical Review have been trying hard to raise public awareness of this crucially important reality and the profoundly harmful consequences this has for Americans and humanity. Now, this awareness is growing, and it's increasingly acknowledged around the world. Just the other day, there was a vote by a United Nations agency, UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, to admit Palestine as a member, as a full member of UNESCO. And the United States, as it had announced it would, voted against this. But the vote underscored more and more the isolation of the United States and Israel in the world. This was noted by an editorial in the Los Angeles Times, for example, that expressed concern that this isolation is going to, already has, and will have increasingly harmful consequences for Americans. The vote in the UNESCO was 107-14 in favor of Palestine admission as a member state. 52 countries abstained, including Britain, and France voted actually in favor admitting Palestine. Increasingly, the United States and Israel have to rely on countries that don't really agree with U.S. policy in this regard, but are bludgeoned or cajoled or bribed into supporting U.S. Policy and Israeli policy and really going along with this power, even though they know better and even though this is contrary to their own interests. But the Los Angeles Times editorial makes the point that the success by Palestine in the UNESCO organization will encourage them to seek membership in other agencies which will have even more impact on U.S. interests, such as the World Intellectual Property Organization, which helps protect patents and copyrights. Now, by U.S. law, again, this is an expression of this power in our Congress, the United States is supposed to withdraw funding from any organization that recognizes Palestine. That is, it goes against what Israel wants in these bodies. Well, this will have increasingly harmful consequences for American property interests, real interests that are going to matter. This is all in addition, of course, to the very terrible price that America has already been paying in terms of dead American soldiers and billions of dollars over the years. Now, the impact of this Jewish Zionist power impacts not only U.S. relations with the Middle East and with Israel, but other countries as well. Even the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, recently has been expressing increased frustration in dealing with Israel. Not because Germany has a special sympathy for the Palestinians, but because of the awareness that letting the Israel-Palestine issue fester has harmful consequences for their own country and the world. Just a few weeks ago, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel was so exasperated in dealing with Netanyahu that she phoned and accused him of once again breaking his word. And she is supposed to have said that she couldn't believe a word that Netanyahu says. Germany announced that it would hold off, at least for a time, on delivery of another first-class nuclear submarine to Israel. But when the time passes in the end of the day, Germany will almost certainly bow to U.S. and Israeli pressure and the power of the Israel-Jewish lobby and give in at the end of the day. But for Germans or for Europeans and increasingly for people around the world, this conflict between and this exasperation of the German Chancellor is another object lesson in the duplicity and arrogance that Israeli leaders have shown. But this, again, is not new. The most prominent German Chancellor in the post-war period after World War II was Konrad Adenauer, and he was the most important German political figure during the late 40s, during the 50s, and up until the 1960s. He once said in an interview, made a remark about Jewish power that deserves to be recalled and highlighted again and again. He was explaining why it is that he decided in 1952 to make a treaty with Israel and with the international Jewish organization, the World Jewish Congress representative, and agree to pay billions in reparations to Israel and to World Jewry. In explaining this, Konrad Adenauer said, and I'm quoting, "The power of the Jews, even today, especially in America, should not be underestimated." Now, taking that into account and acting in accord with that, Adenauer knew, especially in those years, that Germany didn't have the power to fight against that kind of hold, that kind of power. And so he agreed to that Germany would give in and capitulate to this power. But The important thing here, I want to emphasize, is that Adenauer was willing to state bluntly during a recorded interview that he did so because he was bending to what he called the power of the Jews, a power, he said, that should not be underestimated. Now, one of the remarkable things is that around the world, there is far greater awareness of this power and this reality than there is in the United States. Part of the reason for that is that the Jewish Zionist hold on the American media and on American political life is so tight, is so impressive, that Americans are kept in ignorance, are misled and misinformed about the reality of this tremendous power. In fact, for an American politician even to acknowledge that there is such a reality as Jewish power, as Konrad Adenauer acknowledged years ago, is considered anti-Semitic. And any politician, any public figure who talks openly about Jewish power and acknowledges that the organized Jewish community wields and uses this power to promote its own particular ethnic community interests, even against the interests of America in the world, is denounced, shunned as a so-called anti-Semite, and their career is ruined. But around the world, there's far greater readiness to acknowledge that than there is here in the United States. I put a far greater level of responsibility for the ignorance of the American public at the hands, I point far more to the failure of leadership in our country than I do to the ignorance of the mass of the American public. Because, as in every society, people hope or expect or assume that if there's an important reality, their political and their cultural leaders, educators, will talk about it. But here in this country, politicians who know better will not speak frankly and openly about this reality. Now, this flap involving Sarkozy and Obama and this background to this power is all the more important and relevant right now because it takes place against the backdrop of fear of a new war in the Middle East. During the past few weeks, there's been a tremendous amount of media attention and discussion of the possibility of an Israeli military strike against Iran. This has been reported in around the world in newspapers and on television and so forth. And in Israel itself, the major media has reported that Netanyahu and Ehud Barak, who is the defense minister in Israel, are in favor of a Israeli military strike against Iran because, they say, Iran is developing a nuclear military capability. The Israeli newspapers report that so far a majority of Israeli cabinet members and the former head of Israel's domestic and the head of Israel's foreign intelligence services are strongly opposed to an Israeli strike against Iran. They fear that the consequences would be catastrophic in the long run for Israel, however much that might be useful for Israel in the short run. The continued speculation about this has attracted enormous attention in the last several weeks, with the Chinese and Russian governments warning against the dangers of any such strike, any such action. Well, there a number of observers have been emphasizing that much of this may be posturing. It may be only for a show. One of the shrewdest and most insightful observers of Israel reality is a man named Yuri Avneri. Yuri Avneri is a peace activist. He was at one time a member of the Israeli parliament, and his columns are remarkably lucid and insightful, and very often they're posted on the website of the IHR. In a recent column, he deals with the speculation about a possible Israeli strike against Iran and states categorically that the discussion is a ploy. It's a hullabaloo. It's a fraud. It may be intended, he thinks, to frighten and deter the Iranians. Perhaps it's meant to push the United States into taking some military action. And it may even be coordinated, he thinks, with the Americans in advance. But Avneri says, let's be serious for a moment. Israel will not attack Iran, period. Some may think I am going out on a limb. Shouldn't I add at least probably or almost certainly? No, I won't. I shall repeat categorically, Israel will not attack Iran. Now, Avneri says this because he believes that as long as the United States does not support Israel in doing that, Israel would be absolutely mad to carry out a military strike against Iran without American approval and backing, because the United States is the only significant ally left for Israel, and that to do that would be madness. Now, he may be right, he may be wrong. We don't know. We don't know what's really behind the scenes here. But, in fact, it could be that Netanyahu is so confident, and the Israeli government is so confident, that if there is a war, that the United States will jump in to help Israel if Israel is in any real danger, that he could count on Israel sustaining whatever Iran is able to do in retaliation against an Israeli strike. But if the danger becomes really great, if it escalates into a regional war, then in that case, it may be, Israel believes that it can count on support of American politicians to go to bat for Israel. The result of that, of course, would be huge destruction, loss of life, a large amount of suffering and death in the Middle East. But at the end of the day, it would mean that a devastating blow to countries that Israel considers to be hostile. It could very well be that Israel calculates that in the turmoil of a war, it could carry out some sort of ethnic cleansing action against Palestinians. Again, this is speculation. We don't really know. Another American Jewish commentator expressed the view that all of the speculation and talk of war is really designed to get the United States to carry out military action against Iran. Again, we really don't know for sure. Another person who's commented on this is Charles Krauthammer, who is one of the most prominent Jewish writers in America, who consistently takes a very strong pro-Israel position in his columns and other writings, which appear in many, many American newspapers. He was recently asked, will Israel launch a military strike against Iran if it's developing nuclear military capability? And Krauthammer took the view that Israel would not attack. And the reason that he gave is that when Israel has attacked in the past, whenever it struck against another country, against Egypt in 1967, or against Lebanon or some other country, it has done so always without any prior announcement or fanfare. It simply goes ahead and does it, and there's no big media buildup beforehand. Well, maybe he's right, but that's a factor worth considering. But a country that talks about war and threatens to attack another country, it runs a risk as well, because it means that if it does not take action, it runs the risk of not being taken seriously when there is a real threat, or it might really be carrying out military action, because the tendency will be for people around the world and governments to dismiss the talk as more empty rhetoric. The American media has been blowing up for weeks and months and years the so-called danger to the world posed by a nuclear-armed Iran. Well, Iran insists, of course, that its nuclear program is an entirely peaceful one, that it is not developing any nuclear weapons capability, and that, therefore, all the talk about a so-called danger of nuclear-armed Iran is all empty rhetoric, empty talk. We don't know. I mean, it may be that Iran is developing a nuclear weapons capability. But even so, to assume or think that that should be an adequate reason for attacking Iran is very, very dangerous. The proof of this is the fact that this supposed threat and this policy, this attitude, is not applied to any other country. Many countries, no, not many, but a number of countries have a nuclear weapons capability. Both Pakistan and India have nuclear weapons. And, of course, Israel has a large nuclear arsenal. To put it another way, if the United States were to treat Israel by the same standards, or hold Israel to the same standards that it supposedly holds Iran, or that it held Iraq, the United States would be bombing Tel Aviv, invading the country, seizing Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders, and putting them on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity and for violations of international law, because that's what Israel is doing consistently, relentlessly, week after week, month after month, year after year. Israel's nuclear arsenal doesn't even have the pretense or veneer of any kind of cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's utterly, completely unilateral and in violation of international standards. But more than that, Israel's policy of building settlements on the West Bank, its occupation policy, treatment of Palestinians, of non-Jews, is completely illegal under international law. But the United States turns a blind eye to that. And this is especially embarrassing for the Obama administration, which, when it came to office, raised expectations to a very high degree, expectations that, and hopes that, in the meantime, have been betrayed and have been dashed and have led to a great disappointment and disillusionment, not only in the United States, but around the world. When, shortly after Obama was president in 2009, he visited Egypt and gave a very much heralded, much publicized speech to students at a university, major university in Cairo. And in this speech, he said that the oppression and mistreatment of Palestinians is intolerable. That's the word he used, intolerable. Well, Barack Obama has shown that those words were not sincere. They weren't serious. And he's proven very able to tolerate the supposedly intolerable. But the effect of those words and the kind of rhetoric that, and the rhetoric of Obama, not only when he was first in office, but even before he became president, on the one hand, in contrast to his policy on the other, has been one of great disillusionment, great sense of betrayal by America and the world. And again, this extends not only to foreign policy, but also domestically here in the United States, because Obama has not come through and lived up to the pledges and the hopes and the expectations that he raised. What's increasingly happening, as I mentioned earlier, is the emergence of a new bipolar world. I've made this point for years. In 2005, for example, I gave an address in which I stressed that the United States and Israel on the one hand and the rest of the world on the other is a new bipolar alignment of forces that is emerging. And this shift in power relationships is strikingly and has been reflected in votes in the United Nations, and once again recently in the vote by the United Nations UNESCO organization, which points up, underscores the increasing isolation of the United States and Israel. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Rober Report. I hope you'll join me the next time.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.